brains. So I'm just looking straight at my computer and I keep seeing Sandra M. from Copenhagen. Would you please open us with a serenity prayer? Oh no, we can't hear you. Shoot. Okay, she could like do it along with the next person. Thank you. I would have loved that. All right, let's see. All right, the next person I happen to see here then is Dale K. Would you be willing to open us up with a serenity prayer? Awesome. Hold on, let me make sure. There you go.
Sure. Can you hear me?
Can hear you.
Great. Okay. Are we doing it now?
Yes.
Moment of silence, followed by a serenity prayer, please. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Thank you.
Thanks, Dale. All right, Bill, we're ready for you. It's you. You're on. Thanks, everybody.
All right. Thank you, Patricia. My name is Bill Hillebrand. I am an alcoholic. Just for the full disclosure, I'm also a grateful member of Al-Anon, but I'm not going to spend too much time talking about that today because I've been asked to do the AA view or the AA experience of emotional sobriety. And I have a couple of things to say as we begin. First, I'd like to see how many note takers we have in the Zoom room today. We have some note takers. Okay, I have three things for you to write down right now because I know I'm a note taker too. And it's kind of like going up to bat the first batter of the first inning of the baseball game. You just need to get that first contact with the ball and then you'll relax. So I think this information is helpful. Andrea's already getting it. But I do have a couple things I think we will refer back to a lot during the next 16 or 17 hours, however long this lasts. I have way more material than we need for the workshop. So I'm already doing the Bob Seger, what to leave in, what to leave out. Here's the first thing to write down. Three simple words. We seek security. Not just alcoholics, not just Al-Anons, people, human beings seek security. And under that, right, the question is, do we seek security from uncertainty, or do we seek security in uncertainty? We seek security. We seek physical security, material things. We seek social, human contact security, and we seek sexual security. We seek three fundamental primitive kinds of securities, which we're going to talk a lot about because, believe it or not, this whole notion of emotional sobriety did not begin with Bill Wilson's article in The Grapevine in 1958. It runs through the entire recovery program, beginning with the Big Book in 1939, 12 and 12 in 1953, and all of the Al-Anon literature, of course. And we'll also see that it's been running through human history since forever. I only went back for this workshop to 400 BC. I only went back 2,400 years, which I shared just a little bit of, that we're being driven. We people are being driven. We seek security in the social sense, in the material sense, and in the sexual intimate comfort sense. Here's another thing I'd like you to write down. We're going to talk about emotions. You can't talk about emotional sobriety, emotional recovery. You can't talk about emotional sobriety without talking about emotions. And believe me, I've tried. I tried for years in recovery to ignore emotions entirely. And I'll tell you a little bit about that. So we're going to deal with emotions this afternoon. We're going to deal with them carefully. And I'll tell you three reasons why we deal with emotions carefully. You might want to write this down. This may surprise some of you, but probably not. Emotions are often unpredictable. Emotions are often uncontrollable. Emotions are often unexplainable. And we're going to spend quite a bit of time this afternoon seeing those three things, how they play out in our life and how we deal with them, how we deal with them without recovery, and how we deal with them with recovery in recovery. Emotions are unpredictable, uncontrollable, and unexplainable. I want to thank Patricia, before I go any further, for being such a wonderful hostess and facilitator and, gosh, ringleader, groundskeeper. How many titles can we add to you? We'll get you a promotion before the day's over. I want to thank Billy W. Everybody give Billy a big thumbs up. He's been facilitating World Without Borders for what? Calendar Without Borders, what, 30 years now, Billy, it seems like? Going back, I remember, was this started this in March? Did Yvonne start this in March, late March, early April?
I believe we started the third week of March. I can't remember how many we had, but I have pages and pages of recordings from them. So
good for you. You've been here the whole time. Thanks, Yvonne. Hope she's having a nice soak in the spa right now. As I said, I'm an alcoholic. My name is Bill, and my sobriety date is the 18th of March, 1981. I am not a professional psychologist, but I'm going to talk about emotional sobriety anyway. I'm not a professional psychologist, psychiatrist, or counselor. I'm not a priest or a rabbi or a minister. But I'm going to talk about emotional sobriety anyway. I'm not a professional big book person. I'm a big book enthusiast. I used to be a big book thumper. The difference between a big book thumper and a big book enthusiast is this. A big book thumper reads the book so he can cram it down your throat. I didn't know I was that way, but I was that way for a long time. There's people on this meeting today that knew me when I was that way. Please forgive me if I haven't apologized before. Today, I'm a big book enthusiast. I read the big book for my growth, to help me grow my spiritual program, to help me grow my emotional sobriety. And in my enthusiasm, I love to share the big book with others. And if you get anything from it, it's between God and you. I hope you get something from what we talk about today. I hope you get something from the part of my story I'm going to share with you today. And I'm going to share a lot of my story because after this first 30 minutes or so, which I'm going to use to talk about different things I've learned over the years and over the last month about emotional sobriety. After this first 30 or 40 minutes, we're going to go through the 12 steps. We're going to go through the 12 steps one step at a time. And we're going to look at the 12 steps as they seem to apply to emotional sobriety. As they seem to apply to emotional sobriety, both from the literature, primarily the big book, and the 12 and 12 of Alcoholics Anonymous, and also from my own experience and the experience of lots of other men and women I've been going to meetings with and participating in these fellowships with for the better part of 40 years now. I am not a professional. Tina said it so well earlier today. We have one rank in the recovery fellowship, is called member. So everybody here is equal. If you're sober one day, 1 month, 3 months, 1 year, 30 years, 40 years, we have one rank. It's called member. I have done a little research. We have done emotional sobriety workshops before here in St. Louis. So in that sense, this is not my first rodeo, but beginning and end, I'm really just another alcoholic. Sober alcoholic, sober alcoholic, doing the best I can to work the 12 steps, not only in my life, but they make up the framework of my entire life, one day at a time. So all that said, a couple things about me, and then I'm going to get into the outline. I did not come to Alcoholics Anonymous to stop drinking. I know our third tradition says in AA, the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking, and I understand that. And I did get that after a while, but I did not come here, just so you understand. I did not come to recovery to stop drinking. I came to recovery to get the heat off because I didn't have a problem. Every apparent problem in my life was due to other people, other organizations, other institutions, other religions, all religions. God was a big problem. No matter where I turned, God wouldn't go away. I spent 3 years in the 60s trying to be an atheist. That's how committed I was to be an independent, self-reliant. God just wouldn't go away. I've been trying for years to get away from God. He just won't disappear. I came here to get the heat off. I was going through my second divorce. I was losing those kids in the divorce. Nobody talked to me except people that worked for me, and they had to. And my drinking had gotten worse, and the consequences of my drinking had gotten worse again. I had 7 years in the 60s, my first 7 years of drinking after I took my first drink in 1960. I ended up leaving college after 4 years with no degree, getting married and getting divorced in a few months in 1965, going in the Marine Corps so I could go to Vietnam and commit suicide with honor. I thought suicide by Viet Cong would be honorable. That's the way I thought in those days, Noel. Ended up in prison, spent a few months, didn't like that. And in 1967, this Navy psychiatrist who was helping me try to beat my third court-martial, beat an out of dishonorable discharge, said, you know, you don't have trouble unless you drink. He had 7 years of my record in front of him. I said, I know, that alcohol's a problem. He said, you know, if you quit drinking, you probably wouldn't get in this kind of trouble. I said, I know. He said, if you're willing to quit, I'll help you. And I said, you're on, I'm with you. Now, Al-Anons, let me make one thing real clear here. Al-Anon, particularly pay attention. When an alcoholic seems to agree with you, repeat back what you think he meant. Oh. Because when I told that psychiatrist, I'm ready to quit, he thought I meant quit drinking. I meant quit getting caught. It's his fault he didn't follow up. That was not on me. If you didn't understand that, call your sponsor. They'll help you. So I spent the next 13, 14 years doing a much better job of not getting caught. Got married again, had two wonderful children, got a great job at the railroad, and got promoted. And by 1980, I had an executive leadership job on the railroad, and I was basically king over five states and 5,000 people. And I didn't think I had to worry anymore about getting caught. And I'll tell you a little bit about that later, but it did finally lead me 40 years ago this summer and fall. I met Tina in June of 1980 and realized if I didn't quit drinking, I was going to ruin this too, because I'd ruined every other relationship I had. And I started trying to quit drinking on my own. And I really meant it. I really wanted to quit drinking. And I couldn't. I could not stop. And I really wanted to stop. I had every reason to stop. I had no good reason to continue to drink, and I could not stop. And I tried and I tried. In September, 40 years ago this month, the wheels really came off. Public problem, public embarrassment, problems with customers. And I finally went to somebody in December, asked for help, and they sent me to AA. I went to my first AA meeting in January of 1981. Not to quit drinking, just to get the heat off. And there was a man in my first home group in Kansas City. It was a Power and Light group. We met at 6:30 on a Monday evening. There was a man there named Jim C. And Jim C. used to say these words in every meeting, no matter what the topic. He figured out a way to get these words in. You know, it's good for me to be here to quit drinking, but what I'm really here for is a rearrangement and displacement of ideas, attitudes, and emotions. Jim C. said, every time, and I was in that home group for 2 years before we went to Arkansas, every Monday, Jim C., no matter what the topic. You know, I'm here to have a rearrangement and displacement of ideas, attitudes, and emotions. I heard emotions in my very first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I heard emotions in every meeting of that home group that Jim C. attended for 2 years. And we're going to see where Jim C. stole that sentence from. Because I found out after I started reading the big book, Dale, I was a little slow. I didn't see it for about 7 months. But I ran across this in the big book one day, and we're going to see it here in a little bit. It's in the big book. This whole idea of rearranging and displacing our ideas, attitudes, and emotions is in the big book. Jim was cheating. He was plagiarizing. He was saying something that sounded like he was wise without attributing it to the big book. I spent all weekend so offended, I couldn't wait. Not that I had emotional issues. I couldn't wait to get back to that Monday night meeting, and I confronted him. I accosted him at the coffee pot outside the meeting before the meeting. I said, you cheater, you liar. He said, what? He's an attorney, you know, he right away goes on the defense. He says, what? I said, you've been talking about rearranging and displacing your ideas, attitudes, and emotions. You got that from the big book. And he starts laughing. And my sponsor's standing there, who also sponsored Jim. And my sponsor starts laughing. And I look around. There's 9 other men laughing. I'm very sensitive, you know. I'm an alcoholic. You think you Al-Anons are sensitive? I'm sensitive. These men are laughing at me. And I hold up my book. And I said, I'm serious, this is in the book. And they said, where do you think we get all our material? There hasn't been an original thought in this meeting for 13 years. If you hear anything worthwhile in this meeting, it probably comes from the big book or the 12 and 12. Right, Debbie? Well, I didn't pay much attention to that, but I remembered that when I was looking at the stuff for this workshop over the last couple of weeks, and I realized I didn't have to know. And by the way, this is very good news for each of us. I did not have to know that I was recovering my emotional sobriety for the 12 steps to be recovering my emotional sobriety. One of the greatest pieces of news about everything that comes to us that's a benefit and a blessing in the 12 step, we don't have to know it's happening for it to happen. In fact, in the beginning, I was much better off not to know almost everything I'm gonna talk to you about this afternoon or this evening, depending what part of Copenhagen you're in. Thank God, I do not have to know what's happening. In fact, I am really better off in the beginning not knowing what's happening, because if I know what's happening, I'll get in the way. I do not know what's good for me all the time. In those days, I didn't know what was good for me hardly any of the time. So we're going to talk about emotions this afternoon. You can write this down if you don't have an outline. 3 words. Emotions just are, A-R-E. They're not good, they're not bad. Emotions just are. Now, sometimes we use feelings. sometimes feelings is a synonym for emotions, but not all the time. And my good friend Leslie and I talked about this the other day, and she pointed out we don't want to make people think that feelings and emotions are always interchangeable, because they're not. What we're going to be talking about today is primarily emotions, these fundamental drivers that are deep down, they're hardwired virtually in almost every one of us. See, there's all kinds of use for the word feeling. Now watch this. I felt that. Well, yeah, I did. I just slapped my face. If you weren't paying attention, I'll do. People that can't see the video, just listen real carefully. Yes, I slapped my own face. But I'm not going to do it a third time. I'm making progress. I felt that, but that's not the kind of feeling we're talking. If I walk outside, there's a beautiful breeze. I can see the trees out here. We got these beautiful windows looking out over our patio into the little forest area here, and there's a nice little breeze. If I walk outside, I'll feel the breeze on my skin. I'll feel the breeze in my hair. That's not the kind of feeling we're talking about. I put a cup of coffee in the microwave this morning, got it a little too hot, pulled it out. The cup was hot. I spilled it, and I put a little hot coffee on my wrist. I felt that. But that's not the kind of feeling I'm talking about. We're talking about inside. We're talking about those deep, deep-seated emotional feelings that just are. Emotions just are. And here's the formula. I will tell you, the first 10 times I heard this, it made no sense. In fact, I thought it was offensively complicated. But it is vital that we try to understand the next couple sentences I'm going to say, because it really makes sense, and it makes the big book and the 12-step recovery program make a lot more sense when we understand this. Emotions are not at the top of the hierarchy of self. They want to be, but they're not. As soon as I have a feeling, I feel it. As soon as an emotion kicks in, even before I think about it, and we'll talk a lot about that, my thinking, my brain immediately decides how I'm going to deal with this emotion. Now, it happens so fast, you're not aware of it most of the time. But we're going to walk through an example in a minute really slowly, and we're going to take this apart piece by piece. My thinking decides how I deal with my emotion, even including, I don't even think about it, I just do it. Well, not thinking is thinking. Just like not making a choice is making a choice. Thinking decides how I deal with my emotions. Here's the best piece of news I'm going to give you this afternoon. Your thinking is not in charge either, although it wants to be. My will decides what I'm going to do with my thinker. And yes, your will is something separate from and superior to your thinking. Will, thinking, emotions, and somewhere in the complication we get action. I'm going to walk through this because it's really important to understand this. It's the way we're wired as humans, not just as people in recovery. Thinking decides how I deal with my emotions. My will directs my thinking, and here's why that's good news. If the 12 steps are going to introduce God's will in my life, to redirect my will, which is the whole purpose of the 12 steps, develop a relationship with a power greater than Bill that will help Bill redirect his thinking. If my will is not superior to my thinking, then God's will redirecting my will is a waste of time. And if you don't want to believe this, or if it's too complicated, it is Labor Day Saturday afternoon. I know this is a little bit of heavy lifting, but this next 5 minutes is the heaviest lifting we're going to do today. After this, it's going to be kind of like a roller coaster ride, a lot of emotional ups and downs, and lots of fun. So hang in there for the next couple minutes. My will ultimately directs my thinking. Way too often, my will just goes along with my thinking. Yeah, whatever, that was my will. Yeah, if it feels good, do it, whatever. My thinking, we will see, has an influence over my emotions. Not having them, but what to do with them. Emotions just are. They happen before you can even think about it. But deciding how to respond to my emotions, deciding what to do with my emotions, involves thinking. And that's going to involve some will, which means some choice. So write it down this way if you're writing this down. 1, 2, 3, 4. What we're seeking here, what we're seeking in the so-called emotional sobriety, is for God's will to direct my will. That's number one. We're seeking to have God's will direct my will. That way my will can change my thinking from some of those old habits into some new habits that I'm not going to be comfortable with, and we'll see why 6 and 7 really are there. Step 6 and 7. So my thinking has changed to deal differently with my emotions. Not to make my emotions go away. Emotions just are. But to deal differently with my emotions, which will change my actions. God's will directs my will, we hope, which changes my thinking so I can deal differently with my emotions, changing my actions. God's will directs my thinking, my will, which changes my thinking, which deals differently with my emotions to change my actions. I did not invent this formula. But this formula works, and we can go back in history and find out different people saying it in different ways. But you're going to find out this is what human nature really is. So when we pray, for example, when we get to step 10 in the big book this afternoon on page 85, the step 10 prayer is thy will, parenthesis, not mine, be done. Thy will, not mine, be done. This is an application of this thinking, the will, the think, the emotion, the do. This is an example of that hierarchy. It's a recognition of that hierarchy. Thy will, not mine, be done. Even better, we get to the step 11 prayer on page 88. Thy will be done. Even simpler. Thy will be done. It's also why we're going to talk about pause a little bit this afternoon. The very powerful sentence at the bottom of page 87. Bottom of page 87 in the big book. Step 11 discussion. We pause, P-A-U-S-E. We pause when agitated or doubtful and ask God for the right thought of action, thought or action. What are we pausing? The emotion and the thinking. We're using the will to pause the emotion and the thinking before we take a wrong action. You're going to see this formula applied beginning with the doctor's opinion in the big book, beginning in step 1 of the 12 and 12. And I suggest when you read your Al-Anon literature, which I thought Tina did a wonderful job with earlier today, by the way. Bravo, Tina. You're going to see this play out over and over and over again because it is the formula of human nature. So, once more, thinking decides how I deal with my emotions. My will directs my thinking. God's will directs my will, changing my thinking to deal differently with my emotions, which changes my actions, hopefully, for the better. Here's a neat little observation. This really is the hot dog. I'm not perfect. I was wrong, and I promptly admitted. I got to do a little 10 step right there. I accidentally hit my mute button. This is the path of the 12 steps. On the way to having a spiritual awakening, we're going to find emotional sobriety. I promise. I guarantee it. listen up for the next couple hours, see if I'm wrong. On the way to seeking the spiritual awakening, we're going to find emotional sobriety. It's like the bonus round, although it really turns out to be central to our recovery. So what's the problem? What's the reason for the problem? And what's the solution to the problem? Let's spend a few minutes on that. If you have a handout, it's attachment one. If you don't have a handout, don't worry about it. Or if you're worried about it, that's because you're having an unhealthy emotion. So pause and ask God to redirect your thinking through your will. And just trust me, don't worry about it. And if you're still worried about it, stay tuned. Two of the many places in Alcoholics Anonymous that the problem, we're talking about the alcoholism problem for a minute, the problem is described and defined. Let's look at page 22 for a minute for those of you that have a big book handy, or you tech folks like Dale that probably have one online. Page 22 in the chapter affectionately called There is a Solution, even though two-thirds of it's about the problem of denial. Page 22. We are equally positive. Now, these are alcoholics writing this book, 3 years sober and less. They're writing it first and foremost to other alcoholics, but secondly, they wanted this book to be read by non-alcoholics. They wanted this book to be read and understood by family members and friends of alcoholics. They wanted doctors and ministers and psychiatrists to read this book. They had two purposes, right? Two audiences in mind writing this book. Other alcoholics and any person affected by or counseling or working with an alcoholic. So keep in mind, paragraphs like I'm about to read were directed to both the alcoholic and the non-alcoholic. We are equally positive that once he takes any alcohol, whatever, into his system, something happens, both in the bodily and mental sense, which makes it virtually impossible for him to stop. That's the physical allergy of the craving. And I haven't had a drink in 39 and a half years. But if I take a drink or any other mood-changing, mind-altering drug into my body today, that peculiar alcoholic craving, that physical allergy will kick in, and I will not be able to not take the second drink. I will not be able to resist the overwhelming physical demand to take the second hit. That's the physical component of alcoholism. And when this book was written, they just knew that it happened. Science had not advanced to the point where they could explain why it happened. By the mid-1950s, science, and particularly metabolism studies, body chemistry studies, had discovered that the alcoholic really does metabolize alcohol differently than the non-alcoholic. I have a physical craving when I drink a drink my wife does not have. We're sitting in a restaurant when I was about a year sober, nice restaurant. We were probably celebrating the anniversary, and she had a glass of wine. Nice restaurant, so the waiter comes by, sees her wine is almost empty. He automatically tops off her glass of wine without asking, and the rest of the meal, she sips at it. If there's any other alcoholics on here, you know what I'm about to say. And I finish my meal, I finish my dessert, I had my coffee, and that half a glass of wine is still sitting there. Not that I have obsession issues, however. I finally couldn't stand it. I said, aren't you going to finish that wine? And you know what she said? No, I'm starting to feel it. And I think, well, that's the damn point. She doesn't get the physical craving. 90% of us don't get the physical craving. So when they say on page 24 of the big book, a couple pages later in the same chapter, and this is in italics, if you're reading the big book and you something see something in italics, what Joe and Charlie used to call squiggly print, it's really important to them. And here's what he says. So we got this physical allergy, and we got lots of consequences over the years to prove. We probably shouldn't take the first drink because you don't always know what's going to happen, but sooner or later, bad stuff is going to happen. However, he says on page 24, the fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. Our so-called willpower, there's the will, you see. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force. Consciousness is your mind, where you think. Our will is unable to bring into our mind, our consciousness, with sufficient force, the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink. The alcoholic has no effective mental defense against the first drink. Now, Al-Anons, let me reassure you, this is not an excuse for drinking. Nowhere in the book of Alcoholics Anonymous or anywhere in AA literature do we ever offer up alcoholism as an excuse for our behavior. It is an explanation, but it is not an excuse, and there is a big difference. Let me reassure you of that. So the problem is, I cannot physically handle alcohol. And that first night I drank, 1960, first fraternity party, and I didn't have any trouble. I wasn't drinking to escape anything. I was drinking to fit in with these other older upperclassmen, men and women, that I desperately wanted them to approve me. And I had a beer. And I grew up in an alcoholic family. I knew what alcoholism did to a family, and I didn't think I needed to worry about it because I knew about what alcoholism did, and I could handle it. And I had a beer, and I didn't know it, but that physical craving kicked in. I had a second beer, and I had a third beer, and I ended up passing out, throwing up, blacking out, and being hauled home by my date, who I don't think I dated again after that. And I don't blame her a bit. I drank alcoholically the first time I drank, and I just thought that I needed practice. Well, I practiced all right. I have a physical problem that says I can't process alcohol. I have a mental problem that says this time I can handle it. So what's the reason for the problem? Well, there's nowhere better in the book. It's discussed many times, but this is one of the most quoted paragraphs in the history of AA. It's in the doctor's opinion. If you have a big book, a fourth edition, it's on XXVIII, Roman numeral 28. I'm going to read this because it is splendid. Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it is injurious, they cannot after a time differentiate the true from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. They are restless, irritable, and discontented. There's some emotional stuff there, folks. They are restless, irritable, and discontented unless they can again experience the sense, that's an emotion, the sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few drinks which they see others taking with impunity. After they have succumbed to the desire again, as so many do, and the phenomenon of craving develops, they pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful, with a firm resolution not to drink again. This is repeated over and over unless this person can experience an entire psychic change. Psychic is here, change the way we think. There is very little hope of his recovery. A psychic change alters how I deal with my emotions. think, feel, act, even though it happens in reverse. I have to become willing to pause when I feel the emotion, when I experience the emotion. And before I go along with it, use the thinker to pause before I act. He says we need an entire psychic change. And that business about pass through the well-known stages of a spree, resolve not to do it again and repeat it over and over, I can't tell you, and every alcoholic on here can remember waking up morning after morning after morning, hungover, bloodshot, dehydrated, couldn't lay down without hanging on. Never gonna do that again. That's at 6 a.m. because I got up, got on that shirt and tie and coat and went to work and pretended I looked good until about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. You have enough cigarettes, you have enough nicotine, you have enough coffee, you have enough caffeine. By 3 o'clock, you start thinking. See, you start thinking. Well, it wasn't that bad. I probably overreacted. I'm actually feeling pretty good right now. Yet it was probably the cheese. It probably wasn't even the booze. It was probably bad cheese at that. Remember when the bars had those terrible jars with the eggs in them? Anybody remember that? The pig's feet? Yeah, Patricia remembered that. It was probably the egg. And by 6 o'clock, having that second martini, looking at myself in the mirror going, man, I'm glad I got over that. I want to consider some of the definitions we just read in this little piece from the doctor's opinion. What's an effect? E-F-F-E-C-T. It's a change. If I like the effect produced by alcohol, I like the change as a result of taking that drink. A sensation, of course, is a feeling, and it's, we're not talking about that feeling on the outside. We're talking about that change of emotion. Remember, alcohol is a depressant. One of the great ironies in human history, we get drunk and call it getting high. Alcohol is not an upper, it's a depressant. Even what we call alcohol is a lie. It's not a high, it's a depressant. It also pretty well shuts down the frontal lobe, so you're... impulse control is pretty well wiped out. Restless. He talks about restless, irritable, discontent. Restless means having no physical or emotional rest. Having no emotional rest. My feelings are all over the map. Irritable. Now, this will surprise the Al-Anons. Oh. Irritable means easily made angry. Discontent, a restless desire for something else, desire for something more. That comes out of our emotions, as we're going to see. It's a craving. And it's not just physical, it's emotional. What is ease? Absence of difficulty. 3-4 drinks, I felt peace. It was a complete lie, but all that restless, irritable discontent went away. Comfort, ease of feelings of distress, desire, strong feeling. So what's the solution, my friends? Here's a solution statement that Jim Clary was quoting in my first meeting, and I didn't know it for many months. It's on page 27, page 27 of the big book, and it's a story about a fella in 1930, give or take a year, named Roland H., who was a son of a rich family from Rhode Island who had been sent to Europe 2 or 3 times trying to get treated for his alcoholism. Keep in mind, this is 5 years before Bill Wilson got sober and 9 years before the book was written. Roland H. was with Dr. Carl Jung, the famous psychologist. He had tried to go to Freud. Freud wouldn't have anything to do with alcoholics. He tried to go to Adler. Adler was too busy, and Jung was the other one of the big three psychiatrists of the day. The good news about Carl Jung, unlike Freud and Adler, Carl Jung believed in the spiritual. Carl Jung believed in the other, the supernatural. And here's what the story goes. After Rowan was back to see Jung for the second time, I pick up on page 27 of the big book. The doctor said, talking about Carl Jung, "You have the mind of a chronic alcoholic. I have never seen one single case recover where that state of mind existed to the extent it does in you." And Roland said to the doctor, "Is there no exception?" And the doctor, I could just picture Jung leaning back, puffing on his pipe, saying, "Yes, there are exceptions to cases such as yours. They appear to be in the nature of huge emotional displacements and rearrangements, ideas, attitudes, and emotions, which were once the guiding forces of the lives of these men, were suddenly cast to one side. I have been trying to produce such emotional rearrangements within you. I have never been successful with an alcoholic of your description." And if I'm Roland and I'm hearing the good doctor say that, the hammer has come down. There's nothing left for me to have a bodyguard or be locked up. But notice the centerpiece of the doctor's attempted therapy is what Jim C. was saying in my very first meeting, emotional rearrangement and displacement, which we've later come to call emotional sobriety. So where are we? Well, now we have a drunk. Let's say Bill comes to AA in January, did not have a desire to stop drinking. By March 18th, I finally developed a desire to stop drinking and took my last drink. I went back to that home group. Let's see. January 18th was a Thursday. So Friday was the 19th, went to a meeting, met a guy who took me to a meeting on Saturday the 20th. He took me to a meeting on Sunday 21st, and I'm back in my home group. Then it would have been Monday, January 22nd. So now we have a dry drunk. Mm-hmm. We have Bill, who hasn't had a drink now in 4 days. I got the business about no physical, can't have a drink, cannot have the first drink because of the physical allergy. I understand that I need help with my thinking that says I can have a drink. So I've got an understanding of the problem. I can't take the first drink. I still don't understand how much help I need with my thinking. And this is just where the alcoholic picks up with the Al-Anon. When you get to the middle of step one of the 12 steps, once the drink is behind the alcoholic, once the alcoholic is living in abstinence, well, all of a sudden we're together at the starting line. Because we're all powerless over something. I was powerless over my obsession of alcohol. The Al-Anons are powerless over their obsession with fixing at least one other person. And let's face it, once we get into Al-Anon, we realize it's a longer parade than just one other person. We've been trying to fix everybody so we'll feel more secure. I'm just saying. So beginning with the second half of step one, we're all dealing with emotional unsobriety, among other things. So now we got a dry drunk. Here's Bill and his home group, January 22nd, 1981. Not taking the first drink 1 day, 1 minute, 1 hour at a time. I'm going to meetings. I'm calling my sponsor, Aaron. Now what? Well, what is emotional sobriety, since we're going to talk about that today? Here it is, real simple. Emotional sobriety, write this down, note taker. Emotional sobriety is the ability to deal with feelings positively. Emotional sobriety is the ability to deal with feelings positively. It does not say deal with positive feelings, because not all your feelings, not all your emotions are going to feel positive. They're not all going to be good for you at the moment. Even though I say emotions just are, they don't always just feel that way. So if you accept the definition, emotional sobriety is the ability to deal with feelings positively. And if you think you know how to do that, we can close now and open it for questions. Alicia in Florida is laughing. I don't think Alicia thinks we should close yet. I could be wrong. Sandra? No? Keep going? Is that Danish for keep going? I got it. The individual who is emotionally sober might not always be walking around bursting with joy, but they will no longer be a victim of their emotions. By definition, emotional sobriety means I'm no longer a victim of my own emotions. This type of sobriety can be defined as just the ability to feel your feelings and go from there. And I took that definition. There are lots of different wordings of this. This one happens to come from the American Addiction Centers, who spend a lot of time helping people understand this part of the problem before they move toward the solution. I wanted to find five words that comes out of that simple little definition. An ability to deal with feelings positively. An ability is the means or the skill to do something. I suggest to you that what we're going to see in the next couple of hours, steps 1 through 9, we learn the means. We learn the skill. We learn the means to do our emotions, to handle, to deal with our emotions differently. In steps 10, 11, and 12, we practice the skill. So in 1 through 9, we're going to learn the skill. 10, 11, and 12, we're going to practice the skill one day at a time. We're going to develop and grow and become better at this ability to have emotional sobriety. Positively, optimism, agreement, acceptance. You may not agree with everything I'm saying today. In fact, there may be a part of you, because of your past experience or something you misunderstood or understood or defined differently than I do, you may violently disagree with something I say today. That's okay. I'm not going to take it personally. But keep an open mind. I may say something today that helps you change your mind. Victim. Pretty much I think all of us know what a victim is, but I want to remind us, it's a person who is harmed, injured, or tricked. The very middle of the step 3 prayer in the Alcoholics Anonymous Big Book on page 63, the very middle of the step 3 prayer has this line: relieve me of the bondage of self. Right in the middle of page 63 of the Big Book. Relieve me of the bondage of self. Relieve me of the victimhood of me. That's a legitimate paraphrase. Relieve me of the victimhood of me by me. I would suggest that it's no different now and then. Being obsessed with the behavior of, the desire to change and or cure another human being, which after all is obviously impossible, that doesn't stop me from trying. Relieve me of the bondage of self. Free me from the victimhood of me by me. What's an emotion? An instinctive or intuitive feeling. They happen. Before I can even think about it, before I can think about what to do about it, before I can understand why it happened, I'm driving down the street. Car passes me and cuts me off. I slam on the brakes. I may not hit the horn anymore. What's my first? I don't have to think about it. What's my first feeling? Fear. Followed on the heels by anger. Followed quickly by the desire for revenge. Punish. At least drive on their bumper all the way to their driveway and pull in their driveway behind them and share with them their terrible driving skills, but that feel, that emotion of fear is instantaneous. Instinctive or intuitive feeling as distinct from reasoning or knowledge. And finally, sobriety. I love this. I did not know this definition before last week. One of the definitions, the primary definition of sobriety, is the natural state of a human being given at birth. I was born sober. Can we have a second moment of silence right now? Now, it didn't take long to go south, but by definition, I was born sober. Oh, there's another definition. Independent from alcohol. Okay, all right, okay. So when the Dr. Jung said to Roland Hazard to be in the nature of huge emotional displacements and rearrangements, he didn't mean he was going to change the way Roland thought, but he was going to help, or the way Roland felt, but he was going to change the way Roland dealt with his emotions. And then on page 52, and by the way, if you have a big book and you haven't read this page in a while, it really is, and it's good for Al-Anons or alcoholics, because the middle paragraph on page 52 is the diagnosis of unmanageability in recovery. The middle paragraph on page 52 of the big book. We had to ask ourselves why we shouldn't apply to our human problems the same readiness to change our point of view. We were having trouble with personal relationships, da-ding. We couldn't control our emotional nature, ka-ching. We were a prey, read victim, to misery and depression. We couldn't make a living. Well, I found out I was about to lose my job, so I was real close to that one. We had a feeling of uselessness. We were full of fear. We were unhappy. We couldn't seem to be of real help to other people. That's a definition of unmanageable life. And then, of course, on page 58, in the honesty paragraph, the beginning of chapter 5, How It Works, he said, there are those two who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders. He goes on to say they too have the capacity to recover if they can be honest. Way back on page 134, the less often read part of the big book, where we're going to be doing some workshops the next few weeks on those later chapters, like the wives and the family afterward, and what I call the pages less traveled in the big book. But there's some awfully good principles for living in there. And one of them, I want to find it here on page 134 in the chapter to the wives. Unless the reason is understood, there may be an emotional upset. Is that the understatement of the year when it comes to relationships early in recovery?
Yes.
Or the relationship before recovery? There may be emotional upset. That's one of the more stunning understatements in the big book. We have a lot of emotional upset. And also, we're going to look a little bit at the 12 and 12 today, but the one I want to cite before anything else in the 12 and 12 of Alcoholics Anonymous on pages 42 to 45. We're not going to read all that today. Sit down, relax, take it easy. We're not going to read four pages all at once. But on pages 42 to 45, step four discussion in the 12 and 12, Bill does a splendid job of identifying and defining the three primary drivers, as he calls it, that tyrannizes. Another example of self-victimhood. He calls it our desires for sex, for material and emotional sobriety. And I said early on today that we're seeking this security for social, material, and sexual security. And let's face it, Bill wrote the big book. It was published in 1939. He had help from a lot of other people. He's the primary author. And then he wrote these essays But he ate great by in the late 40s on the 12 traditions, complimented them with essays about the 12 steps in 1953. The 12 and 12 of AA was published about the same time that Al-Anon was really getting up and running. Obviously, Bill learned a lot between the day he got sober in December 34 and 19 years later when the 12 and 12 was published. So he was able to describe with more accuracy and more eloquence things about the emotions in the 12 and 12, particularly this description 42 to 45 and some other pages we'll cite. But when you go back and look at the big book, you realize he was saying the same thing in 1939. It just wasn't as well described. What's the point of all this? Well, let's come to that letter that people have rediscovered lately, and that's one reason we're having so many emotional sobriety workshops and meetings, and probably the reason Yvonne's doing emotional sobriety this whole month on this particular platform. Bill was severely depressed off and on through the 1950s, and somewhere in the mid-50s, he wrote a letter to another fellow who was severely depressed, which was later somewhat rewritten and showed up in that January issue, January 1958 of the Grapevine. That letter included this paragraph. These adolescent urges, you notice the word adolescent? Everybody remember what it was like to be adolescent? Emotionally adolescent the day I came in here. Number one, you know everything. By the way, adolescent, just a Latin word for teenager. I knew everything. I wanted my way in everything. I had no impulse control. Unfortunately, our culture adopted this strategy in the 60s when we went overboard, if it feels good, do it. We're not recovered from that yet, but that's an outside issue. Remember? That's how I was when I got here. These adolescent urges, Bill says this, that so many of us have for top approval, that's the emotional, perfect security, that's the material security, and perfect romance, that's the intimacy security, urges quite appropriate to age 17, prove to be an impossible way of life at age 47 or 57 and any other age. Then he says, since AA began, I have taken huge wallops in all these areas because of my failure to grow up. He's not blaming anybody else anymore. My failure to grow up emotionally and spiritually. That's in that letter that was in the January 1958 Grapevine. So here's the question. How do we find emotional sobriety? We're going to get into the 12 steps in 5 minutes. Actually, I think we'll take a 5-minute break in 5 minutes, if that's okay, Patricia, and then we'll come back and dig into the 12 steps. But before we do that, if you have a handout, it's attachment 2. If you don't worry about it. I'm going to go through this really fast, but it's for the history buffs. And if you want to do more research, go to Mr. Google. Much of the information is true. I think the information I've written down today is accurate. This is a brief review of attempts in human history to explain our emotions. Before we get into the 12-step version, I just wanted to give you this quick survey. I only went back to 400 BC. I only went back 2,400 years. In about 400 BC, there was a Chinese book, which is still around. It's called the Book of Rites. It's actually several books, kind of like the Big Book. It's a bunch of books in a book, like the Bible. It's a bunch of books in a book. Probably part of the teachings of Confucius. In the Book of Rites, from 400 BC, there are 7 quote-unquote feelings, 7 fundamental feelings or emotions: joy, anger, sadness, fear, love, disliking, and liking. And in this case, joy and happiness are interchangeable. I'm going to jump way up to 1914. Dr. Sigmund Freud, he wrote a piece about the human condition he called narcissism. And he named the character His Majesty the Baby. Egomania, fixation with oneself. especially, this is Freud, especially an obsession with meeting the primary emotional needs of warmth, security, and comfort, which is not too hard to translate into Bill's three, sex, material, and emotional security. Jump forward to 1930, Dr. Carl Jung, who we've already introduced, with Roland Hazard, believed emotional rearrangement was possible. Jump forward to 1970, Dr. Paul Ekman. Anybody ever see the TV show Lie to Me? Lie to Me, about the guy who could read micro expressions and tell what people were really thinking from little twitches in their face. Ekman's the guy they based that show on. He's the one that presented six basic emotions of happiness, sadness, fear, disgust, anger, surprise, later added shame, embarrassment, excitement, and others. And then many, many, many more combinations of those, which led to this whole micro-expression thing. That was in the 70s, 1980s. A fellow by the name of Dr. Robert Plutchik presented, you've seen a wheel of emotions. It looked like a big Technicolor. All these different combinations of emotions, various combinations and intensities. But at the bottom of it, he's got eight primary, what he called bipolar emotions. And you don't have to remember all this. I'm going to make the point in a minute. Don't worry about it. Joy versus sadness, anger versus fear, trust versus disgust, and surprise versus anticipation. Guy at Hazelden Alcoholic Treatment Center in Minnesota in 1986, fellow by the name of Tom Cunningham, he took Freud's idea of King Baby and wrote a piece about, called a King or a Queen Baby, depending on your gender, which was a syndrome of alcoholism. Me, 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 King Baby, Queen Baby. Fast forward to 3 years ago, 2017, there was a study done. Now we're up to 27 different categories of emotions. This is really getting complicated. Until last year, six folks led by a fellow named Fushan Wang and Jason Huang, a couple of Chinese fellows. And if you want to look at their stuff, go to Frontiers in Psychology. Frontiers in Psychology. They were back to four basic kinds of primitive survival emotions that are at the root of all this stuff. And therefore are happiness, sadness, fear, and anger. Happiness feeds our reward. Sadness feeds our punishment. Fear and anger feed our stress. And then they're combined in more emotions, more complex, but they're based on these four. So I say all that to give you this one conclusion. If you think you've struggled with understanding your emotions, you're not alone. People have been studying this stuff forever and coming up with different attempts to explain it. And when we go back to our big book and our 12 and 12 and our Al-Anon literature, we're going to find out. We deal right away with anger and resentment. We deal right away with fear. We deal with happiness and sadness. And I would say Bill Wilson's growing understanding of emotional sobriety over the years. Think about it. He was in contact with, particularly after the big book came out, Dr. Jung. He had correspondence with him. He read a lot of William James. He was in touch with Reverend Sam Shoemaker from the Oxford Group in New York, Ed Dowling, the Jesuit priest here in St. Louis, Dr. Harry Emerson Fosdick, Harry Thibault, a leading psychiatrist. He also had a lot of input from Lois Wilson. You read any of Lois's writings, Lois is right on track with this emotional sobriety thing. How about that wonderful Al-Anon quote Tina gave earlier, the whole basis of the tradition, voluntary compliance with the unenforceable. If that's not emotional sobriety, I don't know what is. Voluntary compliance with the unenforceable? To a bunch of control addicts, and I mean AA and Al-Anon, we're all control addicts. He had a lot of input from Ann Smith, Dr. Bob's wife. Fundamentally sound emotional advice based on her Christian principles. Marty Mann, one of the first women alcoholics who in recovery. Bill had a lot of help. And ended up both in the big book and in the 12 and 12. Very consistently, Bill Wilson wrote very consistently and very accurately about this emotional sobriety component of the 12-step recovery program. Okay, here's your little acronym for the day before we take a 5-minute break. AID, emotional, AID, emotional aid. Steps 1 through 3, we admit, that's the A, we admit our emotions, our powerlessness over them, and our need for help. Don't have to understand them. Don't have to know where they came from. You can be ticked off about them all you want. We're just going to admit. When we go through steps 1, 2, and 3 for emotional sobriety, we're just going to admit we have these emotions. The I in the AID, step 4, 5, 6, identify. We're going to identify our emotions, particularly the objectionable ones. And we'll talk about what the objectionable means here. We identify the objectionable emotions that are causing us trouble. Go back to page 52 if you forgot what trouble is. So the A, steps 1, 2, and 3, we admit our emotions. The I, we identify in steps 4, 5, and 6 what they are. And then 7 through 12, we learn to deal with all of our emotions in a positive manner, which is very different from how we used to deal with them in the past. These so-called excessive urges, as Bill called them. We'll take a break, and if we, Patricia, if you want to do a question or two, we can, but, 6, 7, 8 minute break, and then we'll resume with step 1.